So, I guess as most of you know, I do mostly galaxy stuff rather than globular formation stuff. So basically, this talk is going to be a combination of stuff that I've been thinking about for years and know very well about galaxy formation, and tentative speculation on how this connects with globular clusters and connection with new projects that I've started since I came to this workshop. So I should mention that my collaborators, first of all, old collaborators going back to grad school, Lars Nordquist and TJ Cox. With them, of course, I'm collaborating on simulation work of galaxy mergers, mostly. Over the last 6 months or so, I've been collaborating a lot with Flynn Van de Ven and Remco Pazdenbosch on the stellar kinematics within about an effective radius, comparing simulation results with observations, and in particular Schwarzschild models of observed galaxies. You can actually do a direct comparison between the orbit structure, the full three-dimensional orbit structure measured in the simulations versus reality nominally. And then even more recently, since about the beginning of this workshop, collaborating with Aaron Aronofsky on outer kinematics. That's one of the new projects I've started up. And also with Fred Razio, Mark Iles, and Enrico Mesmerini, we've been having some discussions on the connection of this to this debate about the mass function of globular clusters and running some new simulations dedicated to answering that question. So first, the kind of broad motivation for all of this work is what you might call galactic archaeology. You know, we want to know, how did elliptical galaxies form? Most of the stellar mass in the universe, the local universe, is in elliptical galaxies. So that's sort of asking the question, how did most of the stellar mass in the universe build up? And you can also ask, by studying the globular cluster systems within a galaxy, how did the globular clusters form? I think you can, it seems that we're converging on a picture with all of these different collaborators that I listed on the first slide, in which from the outer kinematics, the halo kinematics, on which you can probe, for instance, with globular cluster systems or planetary nebulae, from the outer kinematics, you can hone in on the morphologies and the merger orbits in a system. You can actually do that pretty sensitively, as I'll show you later. The inner kinematics is probing more the dissipative processes that were important in the merger, the gas fraction, the new stars that formed from the starburst out of gas during the merger. And I think by comparing in the outer parts the stellar and the globular cluster kinematics, or the planetary nebulae and globular cluster kinematics, you might be able to say a lot about how the globular clusters within the galaxy form, as I'll show on some of the latest slides. The outer kinematics is very sensitive to where you started kinematically in a merger. You know, there isn't as much relaxation. The outer parts retain a lot of memory of the initial conditions. And so I think it might be very easy to distinguish between, say, globular clusters that formed in the halo that are basically just little satellite galaxies, like we were talking about this morning, versus a scenario in which they formed in the disk. For instance, I think the outer kinematics ought to be able to directly answer that question. So I guess when you get to these sorts of questions about galaxy formation, you can either take a direct approach. You know, this is more of a galaxies thing. Shapiro et al. 2008, here's some exciting work where they actually do integral field spectroscopy of galaxies around Z equals 2 or 3. So there you're trying to directly look at the galaxies that merged to form present-day ellipticals. But, of course, these are extremely challenging observations. These galaxies are far away, and the data is noisy, and there's terrible selection effects. So the alternative way to do it is to look at galaxies really close, on which you can get explicit data. You know, with Sauron, for instance, you can get these high-resolution spectroscopy over a whole 2D map and lots of spectral bins and reconstruct the full orbit structure and that sort of thing. And you can then try to build up what the progenitors must have looked like based on the details of the present-day distribution functions of these galaxies. And I guess you can use both of these methods and cross-check, and hopefully they tell you the same thing. So I'm just going to fly through these introductory slides right now because you're probably familiar with these things. We now think that elliptical galaxies form through mergers of spirals. We talked about some of the reasons for that this morning, so I won't go through them again. This one maybe I'll dwell on a little bit more because maybe we've talked about it a little bit less during this workshop. The strong evidence that exists that gas processes are important in mergers. And you know, as I'll show on, this might sound pretty irrelevant to the globular clusters right now, but as I'm going to show on some of the later slides, looking at globular cluster systems can really, in a way, confirm this picture through the kinematic twists that you see between the inner parts of the galaxy and the outer parts of the galaxy. Romanowski was talking about that in his talk yesterday. Can perhaps pretty strongly support this picture of dissipative mergers forming, dissipative major mergers forming elliptical galaxies. How do we know that gas is important? Why is that one of the main things that I'm going to be varying in the simulations, how much gas there is? The main argument goes back to, probably the strongest argument goes back to Karlberg, 1986. In this paper, he argued that if you have a collisionless, in any collisionless process, Liouville's theorem holds, conservation of phase space density. And it's a lemma of that theorem, I suppose, that the maximum phase space density cannot increase in a purely collisionless process. So Karlberg just, this is based on observations, just came up with some kind of coarse grained measure of the phase space densities in the cores of galaxies. This is just phase space density versus magnitude. And these boxes here are spirals, and these points here are ellipticals. These have a higher phase space density, right? So these cannot have merged by Liouville's theorem through a collisionless process to be formed. And this was historically used as an argument against the merger hypothesis. It was either used by various people as an argument against the merger hypothesis or an argument in favor of dissipation being important in mergers. Obviously, to have dissipation, you can get around Liouville's theorem. You can increase the phase space density. Much more recently, Cox et al. 2006 also showed that the kinematic properties of elliptical galaxies can be much better explained with gas-rich mergers than they can with collisionless mergers. This is kind of obvious just looking at pictures of some of these systems. They often seem to have cold, fast-rotating components that would be most naturally explained through dissipation, etc. This is looking at basically the ordered rotation scaled to the random motion, sigma v over sigma, and DJ compared an ensemble of 40% gas mergers with dissipationless mergers, and just showed that the statistics of the 40% gas mergers look, in V over sigma, look much more like real elliptical galaxies than the collisionless ones do. Today this argument is a little bit more controversial, but I'm focusing on this because this was maybe the only one of these three pictures that attempts not just to say that gas had to be there, but to quantify how much gas you need. So here, Brent Robertson was looking, and the collaborators were looking at the tilt of the fundamental plane. He shows in this paper that that's actually, in a sense, for a fixed mass, equivalent to this phase space density argument. And he found that to match the observed tilt of the fundamental plane, you needed gas fractions about 30%. Maybe not coincidentally, that's also the typical gas fraction of a spiral galaxy at Z around 2, 2.5 when we think most elliptical galaxies formed. So it would be a high gas fraction today, but for when we think galaxies formed, it's probably pretty typical. And after doing some work, it also points to that same gas fraction being dominant. Before I show you the results, just to briefly remind you of why we're thinking in terms of orbits. Unlike globular clusters, as we've mentioned many times, elliptical galaxies, the relaxation time is much, much longer than a Hubble time, so two-body relaxation is not important at all. Therefore, we can think of these We can think of these systems as being built out of stellar orbits. Once you diffusion along the orbit, the interactions with individual other stars is not important.
Does it matter what happens to that gas? I mean, if it forms stars or if it's ejected? Well, I don't know. Do you have to say, by the way, that 30% is converging to stars, or do you have to say?
Oh, yeah. The gas ends up in the galaxy is what's going to determine the orbit structure, right? What does happen, I don't know if this is driving at your question, what does typically happen to the gas? If you have, say, 30% gas to start out with, probably 15 or 20% of it ends up in a starburst component in the center. So we were talking earlier today about collisions between clouds and that sort of thing. What's going to happen if you have, say, a whole bunch of molecular clouds that kind of bump into each other, and those collisions, they dissipate energy, and then they fall toward the center. And that way the gas is able to lose all of its angular momentum, you know, due to the gravitational torque during the merger. So if it's losing angular momentum and it's dissipated, what's going to happen? It's just going to form a central mass concentration at the center, reach really high densities and form a starburst. If that's what happens to more than half of it. And the fact that it does that is the main thing which is driving change that you get in the orbit structure when you add gas. Some of it escapes the galaxy, but that doesn't really do anything with stellar orbits, right? Some of it just kind of stays where it started out. But, you know, the majority of it is going to end up in a very centrally concentrated starburst component in the center. Okay.
And how do you avoid having the other 10 or 15% at high angular momentum forming a disk?
It does.
And
that's why this, if I go back to, that's why the over sigma is so much higher. You know, this is the over sigma measured at around the effective radius. That's only a little bit of the mass. It stays out there and reforms a disk. But that tiny bit of mass, it's totally streaming, is what makes these. It might only be 5% of the mass of the galaxy, but it's completely ordered rotation, right, in that component. That's entirely what's driving this.
And that's still there today?
That's still there today. It's formed stars. It's not gas anymore.
Right.
But, yeah, it's there in the kinematics. I can show you the plots. That's not what I'm emphasizing in this talk, but
unless the elliptical merges with another elliptical, which destroys the disk.
Right. But I think the hint is that that's not as important as people once thought. That's another point. I don't think most elliptical, some elliptical galaxies look like remerger remnants, but it's they're few and far between.
There's certainly ones that look like that.
Okay, so we're built up of orbits. Just to briefly talk about the four types of orbits in galaxies, since I'm going to be using these terms later in the talk, you have orbits that rotate about the short axis of the potential. That's kind of your standard oblate rotator picture that can serve an integral, which is something like the angular momentum about the minor axis. Then you have two types of orbits that rotate about the major axis of the potential and serve something like angular momentum about the major axis. And then you have these box orbits that have no well-defined sense of rotation and pass arbitrarily close to the center. These three types of orbits tend to avoid the center of the potential, which is something which is going to be important in describing the dynamics of globular clusters, etc. Since this is highly relevant to galaxy evolution and possibly also to globular cluster evolution, in a way I'll mention at the end, let me briefly go through what happens when you stick a central mass concentration in a potential with a lot of box orbits. So you tend to have a lot of minor axis tube orbits and oblate potentials, like your typical oblate rotator disk picture. You tend to have a lot of major axis tube orbits and prolate potentials, and you tend to get a lot of box orbits and highly triaxial potentials with flat cores. Now, what happens if you stick inside of one of those highly triaxial potentials with a flat core a point mass? So this is from Lurie and Merritt, 1997. This is five different box orbits and a fairly flat quarter triaxial potential. You stick point masses inside with 0.3%, 1%, and 3% of the total mass of the spheroid. And this is what happens to each of these orbits. You can see that not that much happens. They get a little noisier when you add the 0.3% and a little bit more, a little bit less elongated in shape, even when you add 0.3% central mass concentration. But a 3% central mass concentration is sufficient to totally disrupt the box orbit gravity stochasticity, because every time it... Remember, these things are sort of the parent orbit of the box orbit is the radial orbit. These things are passing arbitrarily close to the center. And so every time they pass through the center like that, they're going to encounter this strong central mass concentration and scatter off of it a little bit. They fuse around. This destabilizes them until eventually they find a stable minor axis tube orbit.
But 3% is a lot more than that you get from M sigma.
But black holes, in the rest of the talk, yes. So why do we care about this? Black holes are dynamically insignificant in everything that I'm going to talk about. The reason I care about central mass concentrations is because of what I referred to before. What happens to the gas in a merger is it gets driven to the center and forms a central mass concentration. In this thing, if you started out with 30% gas, maybe 15% of the mass of the galaxy, so much higher... much higher masses than anything which is considered here.
And the scales are such that that gas would all be effectively like a point mass at the center?
To a start, the effective radius. Obviously, if you go down to 100 parsecs, then you're within the central mass concentration. But if you're, this talk is going to focus on the effective radius and further out. So at those distances, this basically... the gas that falls to the center basically looks like a point mass. Okay. The key point to take from this slide, this is something that I think is going to be very challenging to do with globular clusters, but at least with stars where you have a lot of signal. A lot of attention, with the rise of integral field spectroscopy, like with Sauron, a lot of attention has been paid to the question of how much information do I need as a fully reconstructed distribution function of galaxies. And the classical Schwarzschild modeling is just done usually from the surface brightness profile. It's been shown to be degenerate. You can find multiple solutions for the orbit structure that all give back. Get a different local minima that all give back the right surface brightness profile, which you can get a bunch of different answers that are consistent with that. These authors, Van de Ven, Van den Bosch, et al., have spent a lot of effort showing that with the first four moments of the line of sight velocity distribution maps, you can, in most cases, pretty much unambiguously reconstruct the full three-dimensional orbit structure of galaxies. And I can show you some plots later that will give you an intuition as to why that might be true. Interestingly, these first authors, this is kind of an interesting-looking galaxy that shows the strong kinematic twist, a lot like lots of real galaxies. I'm going to show you in a minute. I'm sorry if this is the real galaxy of simulated galaxies that I'm going to show you in a minute. So, interesting perspective of anyone. So, Statler et al. In 2004 did Schwarzschild modeling of this galaxy with the surface brightness and the velocity information only. So, basically, we don't even show the surface brightness here. So, basically, using the surface brightness plus just this first column here. As you might expect from just looking at the picture, they got a solution which involved a highly triaxial galaxy with a radical change in the orbit structure about this radius. They got an answer that went from being oblate in here to prolate out here with a strong twist and completely distinct orbit structure in the middle versus up here. These authors redid the analysis using also the H2, H3, and H4 information and got a completely different answer for the orbit structure, which looks very much like what you get in simulations, and I fully believe is correct. which showed that showed furthermore that this really isn't kinematically, I guess it is a kinematically distinct component by definition for the picture, but it's not a dynamically distinct component. There's no sharp change in the orbit structure as you move outward, and I think this strongly supports a picture in which this kinematically, so-called kinematically distinct component it didn't form from something else falling in, you know, like a satellite galaxy or something like you might naively think, but is actually just the result of the merger, that these things can actually naturally pop out without having to evoke, you know, a second system falling in, just from one system evolving naturally. Okay, so these are the types of simulations we did. Very big ass fraction. I think the movie is sufficient. You've heard of these types of things before. Okay, these are just some examples that actually come from a summer student that I had, Gaspar. These are just some pictures of actually outer veil orbits from his thesis that come from just freezing the potential of the simulation at the end, knocking it up with a basis expansion, and then integrating the orbits of stars for 150 dynamical times from the simulation. I'll skip over that. That just shows you how the orbits give you the observed kinematics, but you're going to see more examples later. Okay, so now let me get into globular cluster relevant results. So the first set of results that I'm going to show you, I guess, is answering the first question on my introductory slide. If we just forget that globular clusters are globular clusters and just think of them as tracers of the halo potential, how long can I go on, by the way? About 10 minutes?
Forever.
Okay.
The core is
that's bad. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to show you is... the first set of results that I'm going to show you are aimed at answering questions about galaxy formation for globular cluster systems, not about globular cluster formation. We just treat the globular clusters as random tracers of the halo potential, and we ask what can we learn about galaxy evolution, I guess, from looking at the kinematics of these tracers. So this is an example. This is real stuff from observations. This comes from Kato et al. 2008. I guess I'm cheating a little bit because this is actually planetary nebulae, not globular clusters. But in this context, both are just tracers of the outer halo effect. Stellar kinematics, you can't go out further than about an effective radius. Maybe if you push it to 3 effective radii or something. But with these, with planetary nebulae or globular cluster systems, you can often go out to 10-ish effective radii. So you're really probing the halo potential out there. And in this particular system, you see, how many was it? There's probably about 1,000 globular clusters. 400 globular clusters, okay. That are being used as tracers. Quotes. Please tell me if I'm misrepresenting you, but from the abstract of this paper, twists and misalignments in the velocity fields are more frequent at large radii. And many objects are more rotationally dominated at large radii than in their central parts. And those two generic features also generically show up in the simulations, as I'm going to show you. I think they may be a first confirmation of this merger scenario. So this is from a paper by Cox and Deckel, and I think I'm lucky who the first author was, but anyway, they, Novak was the first author of this paper. So anyway, they present this basic picture in which the stellar component of a gas-rich merger remnant tends to be oblate, and the outer part tends to be prolate. The basic idea, two galaxies come in, this is the direction of their orbital angular momentum. The halo ends up elongated along the direction of approach of the two galaxies. It's primarily supported by velocity dispersion and isotropy. Meanwhile, the stellar component, which contains gas, tends to, since the gas quickly dissipates energy and spins up, the gas ends up in a rotationally supported oblate remnant. where the minor axis tends to correspond to the axis perpendicular to the plane of the merger of the two galaxies, since the orbital angular momentum generally dominates the total angular momentum at the beginning. That makes sense, right? So you expect shape of such a system of a gas-rich, the remnant of a gas-rich merger to twist from an oblate shape in the inner regions to a prolate shape in the outer regions, oriented like this. And that's what's going to be driving a lot of what I'm going to be showing you here. So these are two simulated merger remnants shown at 3 effective radii. These maps go out to a scale of 3 effective radii. And you can see this prominent outer rotation. You can also see kinematic twist, right? This this here is this part, right? This is your oblate rotating disky type of component at the center that forms out of the gas, new stars in the simulation. And then you have kinematically distinct outer rotation, which can be pretty strong. In this case, the outer rotation appears to be faster than that. Than the inner rotation. This is just confirming that basic picture that I showed you in the last slide. So these are basically mock-ups of Sauron maps as a function of gas fraction. So these are just two different merger orbits. They have the same impact parameter, but the disks start with different inclinations relative to the merger plane. And this is just showing you the maps as a function of gas fraction going from 0 up to 40% gas. So this is the picture that I mentioned in the last slide where the at 0% gas, actually most of the collisionless particles just shed all of their angular momentum, shed all of their orbital angular momentum to the dark matter halo, and you're just left with a remnant that's rotating slowly or is dominated by minor axis rotation. The minor axis rotation actually comes from memory of the disk spins. These are prolate systems, don't look anything like real galaxies. As you increase the gas fractions, intermediate mass fractions, you start to get these disky kinematically distinct components in the center. And then as you go to high gas fractions observed within 1RE, these things appear to be totally dominated by oblate rotation, kind of like a fast rotator elliptical. This is what Sauron sees at 1 effective radius. If you zoom out to 3 effective radii, here's what the gas-rich remnants look like. First of all, here's what the gas-poor remnants look like. They look pretty much the same on a scale of 1 effective radius versus 3 effective radii. The only difference is they're rotating a little faster further out. But if you go to these higher gas fractions, particularly focusing on the 30 and 40% gas remnants, you generically start to see this kinematic twist because the outer regions are going to behave basically the same way as they did at zero gas fraction, right? They're not going to be affected by the presence of gas, so they're going to be dominated by minor axis rotation. But of course, the inner regions are dominated by this component that Fred was talking about that reforms out of the gas. And so you generically see these sort of twists in the kinematic orientation in high gas fraction remnants going from the inner parts to the outer parts. Again, this is something you wouldn't see in a Sauron map, but if you probed a bit further out, either using multiple pointings of an integral field spectrograph, and I guess observing for a long time since the galaxies are faint out there, or you probe the outer region with planetary nebulae or globular clusters, you begin to see this twist, which is sort of the signature of this gas-rich merger scenario. This is just looking at some of the variety that you can get in the types of kinematically distinct components, the types of twists that you see as you go out. To call your attention, particularly Aaron and Jay, I know you were talking about seeing a galaxy that's strongly rotating in the center, but as you go further out, all the rotation disappears. And just as I was looking through my maps and preparing this talk, I just randomly noticed this. This is a 40% gas remnant on a kind of polar orbit. This is kind of a weird accident. What produces this, it's entirely a projection effect. This is looking what you would think is edge-on at the disk. But it turns out that the intrinsic orientation of this remnant twists in just such a way as you go to the outer regions that the outer rotation entirely cancels out looking at it in this particular projection. If you look at this in a perpendicular projection, you actually use a strong minor axis rotation in the outer parts. But so here's an example where you have this strong disk in the middle, but if you look at the outer kinematics, totally falls, the rotation completely falls off. In other cases, you get nearly a 90-degree twist in the orientation and the rotation as you go further out, for example. In this case, you get more like a 45-degree twist or something if you go out to the distant regions. And this is an interesting case that I showed because it's like there are three different levels, I guess, or you get two separate kinematic twists depending on how far you go out. So this is the inner regions dominated by dissipation. If you zoom out to three effective radii, it looks like this, dominated by minor axis rotation. If you zoom out to eight effective radii, the rotation starts getting more oblate again. So the kinematic orientation of this would be all over the place if you plotted it as a function of radius between 1 and 10 effective radii.
These are sort of counter-rotating disks. How long they last?
What do you mean by count forever? I mean, you're talking about this is all of these plots are made 380 years after the start of this composition. But this should not evolve with time. This is purely a kinematic signature. I'm not taking into account, stellar age waiting in the luminosity or anything like that. These are just kinematic features that, since these are collisional systems, are going to last forever. You can see this 20 giga years from now.
Are you evolving them in the live potential or the decreased potential and look at the orbits?
Am I evolving them? Oh, so to make these maps that you're looking at right now, all I did was I took the remnant 3 giga years after the start of, 5 giga years after the start of the simulation. Just looked at the instantaneous velocities, picked the line of sight, right? And just looked at the instantaneous velocities of all the particles along the line of sight and just made smooth maps. These maps that I'm showing you don't depend on separately integrating the orbits at all. So this is the direct result of a completely live, self-consistent simulation in which I've evolved these particles.
You see secular evolution in the inner system. Is there any residual coupling between the inner system and the outer system?
That's a good question. You can ask, are these in equilibrium? Like, maybe if I looked at these 20 giga years from now, there would be some kind of smoothing of the boundary between these different parts, right?
More so than possibly.
Right. I mean, the only answer I can give you right now is I've already evolved them for a long time, right?
There's a few dynamical times in the answers. Dynamical times don't become very
correct. If you're looking at this boundary that you see at 3 are effective, you're probably talking about 50 dynamical times or so.
Just generically, when you have misaligned orbits like that, you tend to slow drifting until they eventually end up aligning.
That makes sense, but I suspect that would take much, much longer than a Hubble time. That's my end. Look at it in terms of, I think, a simple argument I can make. These have been here for maybe 50 dynamical times, and they still look like this, right? Now, if you want to ask how long...
3 effective radii, you think, 200 million years. You already
about 10 to the 8 years, I'd say. Okay, so maybe or 20 dynamical times, let's say. I don't recall it exactly. Probably, to some extent, it depends on the type of orbit and that sort of thing.
Depends on what direction you take for the merger as well. You're not merging directly to infinity either. You're merging as a final direction. This is going to be happening versus 2 or something.
Granted.
Yeah, so you only have a few giga years in the hole.
That's true. But no, I guess, granted, I would have to completely answer your question, I would have to run the simulations for much longer. You could probably do it, more simply using this SDF, and then you can integrate the whatever, but that's a separate thing. But one argument that I can make right now, if this is 20 dynamical times, let's say, ask yourself, how long is 20 dynamical times at 10 effective radii? you know, it's going to take a long time. If this wasn't erased in 20 dynamical times, why would I expect this to be erased in 20 dynamical times? And 20 dynamical times out here is a long time.
Yeah.
If you're only interested in things that can be affecting the galaxies I see.
Oh, no, I'm a theorist.
Good point. Maybe a bit related question. There may be some chaotic orbits also, and how do you treat them? I mean, are you sure you catch them?
Right now, you're right. Chaotic orbits can drive spectral evolution. I have done spectral classification in the past, and this is where I didn't actually use the results I'm going to show you because I concluded it was pointless, but and this kind of thing is much faster. But when you do that, you get probably on the order of 10% of chaotic orbits over, where chaotic is defined as K, is not being classified as regular over 150 dynamical times. Of course, for these, that's like 10 Hubble times for these orbits. Right, so we're not dominated by chaotic evolution, although I'm not going to say it's entirely unimportant. It's not going to change the quality of the result. Anyway, should I... No more questions, I'll move on. I'll skip over this stuff because there's a lot of information in this plot. This is just... if I want to get to coming the other way, what we can say about globular cluster evolution, I'll just briefly summarize some of the features that are most important to the kinds of things we're talking about, and the intrinsic structure of the intrinsic orbit structure of the simulated remnant. So it's plotted here. Okay, this block is 0% gas, 10% gas, 40% gas. This is remergers of the spheroidal remnants of high gas fraction. Spiral mergers. Okay, we won't talk too much about these right now. But the top row in each case is just the orbit fraction. Green is minor axis tube orbits, oblate rotating. Red is major axis tube orbits, prolate rotating. Black is box orbits, or as you were in this classification, chaotic orbits would just get thrown in the box orbits, anything that doesn't have a definite sense of rotation. This row here, which I think is relevant to a lot of this, is the fraction of the rotation for the different types of tube orbits. So the green, this is just like n plus minus n minus over n plus plus n minus. So it's, you know, if all of the orbits are streaming in the same direction, it would be 1. If they're completely canceling, it would be 0. And so the green is for the Z-tube orbits, the oblate tube orbits, and the red is for the prolate tube orbits. Okay, and then down here I have the intrinsic shape, the triaxiality, and the elongation. And down here, I plot the intrinsic orientation, just the three Euler angles of the orientation, to see if there are intrinsic twists. So what are some of the generic features that I see? Okay, at 0% gas, everything's dominated by box orbits, until you get to the outer regions. So that's kind of interesting. I think this is highly relevant for mass function stuff, because one possible resolution of this problem, that there seems to be no radial dependence to the mass function, that you don't seem to get enough tidal stripping, I guess that, you know, the outer globular clusters don't encounter strong enough tidal fields to shave off the bottom of the mass function, or whatever, my phrasing the question correctly. You know, one answer to that is, well, maybe they're all on radial orbits. And so they see the center of the galaxy, et cetera. Maybe they're maybe these galaxies are triaxial and they're all on box orbits that pass arbitrarily close to the center. Well, something that you can see is that's not ever true in the outer parts, even for a collisionless merger. In the inner parts, you might have domination by, you know, radial box orbits. But in the outer parts, you never have a higher fraction of box orbits than maybe 20 or 30%. And that's really because of that slide I showed you earlier with scattering off of the central mass concentration. If you're out in the halo, you see the whole stellar component of the galaxy is the same, even if it's collisionless, even if there's no gas, you see the center of the galaxy is the central mass concentration. So you can't really have very many stable box orbits out there. So I think this is showing you that at least, you know, if SARS had always been on the orbits they're on today. At least 70% of them have, so systematically avoiding the center.
You're assuming that all your clusters are unbiased tracers of the halo. There's absolutely no reason
true.
To do that.
Or in this case, unbiased tracers of the stars, which might be an even worse assumption.
Well, the potential
see, this is just stellar there. Orbits, not I'm not including dark matter particles in this. This is limited matter only.
But the potential is defined by a dark matter, surely.
Oh, yeah, for the potential, I'm including everything.
Right, so the potential is dark matter dominated, but the global clusters need not trace that potential in the matter's way.
True, but presumably they're dominated by the whatever it's making. I mean, the potential that a globular cluster feels is going to be dominated by whatever it's making.
Yeah, but the orbits they're placed on may not sample that potential in the same way as the stuff that's generated.
Very true. So and the bias here, the orbits that they're placed on, are sampling the luminous matter in the simulations, which may be a worse assumption than sampling the dark matter, but you could do it in different ways. Right. You could choose whatever tracer particles.
But then don't put any constraints on this. You could put all the globular clusters on purely radio orbits ad initio.
I see.
There would be no constraints.
But if you just, something I should point out, in the outer regions, I've also done the experiment of just isotropizing all the orbits, so that in that case, I keep their energy as whatever it is. But I isotropize the direction of the velocity. So then in some sense, what you're looking at is just how much phase space is available in the potential for the different types of orbits, irrespective of, if they just started on random orbits, right? And the answer that you get when you do that is not very different from this in the outer parts, I should say, in most cases. And so in some sense, I can just, zero order, let's not even worry about the initial conditions in this. Let's just ask, how much phase space is there for box orbits. I mean, granted, I guess if I dump the ball on precisely radial orbits, but that's not realistic, right?
But that's only true of populations that are tracing, that are generating potential. You can play down any tracer population on any shape you want on top of that and pick any subset of families of orbits you want to complete freedom.
I can.
Yeah.
Why you cluster the orbits in a different way than stars?
It depends on how they move. We don't know.
But in
right,
this case, the cluster
should
be
extremely biased when they're in the orbit. That sounds pretty pathological.
I see your point. But in this case, you have the merger of two spirals with a pre-existing population of clusters, which presumably. Have the same kinematics as the
No. Clusters come in spirals do not have the same kinematics as either the gas or the star population.
What scenario is there that would put them all on perfectly radial orbits? What this is saying is there's another
space
that's available for radial
here's a scenario. Globular clusters are made
never
from...
Never charge stands.
Globular clusters are made from strong shocks and colliding gas clouds.
Okay.
So they tend to form mostly in the halos by cold gas lumps colliding together near head-on collisions. They form starburst and drop straight down the center. I'm not saying that's
okay,
how we do it.
I hear you.
I'm
that's
saying
a,
there are physical
possible.
Scenarios where the globular clusters are highly biased traces of potential. So you have to be careful what you're concluding from the property of the potential to saying whether the globular clusters are a fair trace of potential.
Granted. I mean, if there's something like that, that they're all, that something about the formation mechanism puts them all on extremely radial orbits, then
okay.
But I can't say that from this simulation here. I'm just trying you understand Okay. So let me.
What is the relationship between the energy percentile and the distance? I understand that. Can you say 0.5 correspond to what?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So this is 40th percentile corresponds to about the effective radius.
So 40.
40th percentile. So 0.4. If it's a Hertzsprung profile, that statement is true.
Oh, I see.
So the effective radius is about here. The outer parts that you're probing with globular clusters would be, say, maybe the 80th percentile one.
Okay.
So if you're interested in what Aaron and Jay's data is probing, you should be looking at, the upper 20% of these. I won't go into, just one quick thing to note about each of these other sets. Okay, you're dominated by box orbits, only 0%, a 10% gas. Even in the inner parts, the orbit structure gets converted to mostly short-axis tube orbits, although at low gas fractions, they're pretty much all canceling in their rotation, so you don't get a lot of streaming motion. You don't see these fast rotators. They'd be slow rotators. At 40% gas, region more dominated by short axis two warpets, and now they're also streaming, so you get this fast rotation. In the outer parts, though, I should point out where the globular clusters are, the gas fraction doesn't really make much difference. I mean, if you look at, for instance, in this case, the 0% gas fraction remnant is totally prolate, dominated by X2 warpets, and that stays pretty much regardless of the gas fraction in the region probed by, some people who might naively think that adding the center mass concentration globally transforms the orbit structure all the way out in the halo, but that's not true. So in some sense, the globular cluster systems far out really are probing, just the morphology and the merger orbit. They don't really have a lot to do with the gas fraction, which is good because that gives you sort of an independent probe of its. That's not gas fraction dependent, I guess I should say. Okay, so I'll skip over that. So far I've been referring to globular clusters pretty much just as halo tracer particles, or maybe I should say tracer particles of the luminous halo, since I've selected from the stellar orbits. Now, in these results that I'll show you, I'm going to focus more on the question of maybe what can you learn about where globular clusters form within a given galaxy from their kinematics. This is a very preliminary sort of result, but I think it's kind of interesting in light of the discussion this morning. So this is just an example. I've actually forgotten now which one it is. It's one of the 20% gas mergers. 20% gas disk merger remnants, I should say. So at the top, again, we have the orbit population. In the middle, the rotation bias, and at the bottom, the intrinsic triaxiality and elongation, the shape. Okay. So an interesting thing here, if you look out to about the 80th percentile or so in cumulative mass, the Z-tube orbits, although they're the dominant population, are pretty much totally canceling in their rotation. They have very little net rotation. But the X-tube orbits outward of here are like 100% streaming, pretty much. Kind of an interesting result. And this that I've plotted here is averaged over all the different orbits, but as a function of gas fraction, I'm just showing this rotation bias, the green being for the Z-tube orbits, the red being for the X-tube orbits that rotate about the major axis. The solid diamond curve at the bottom, in each case, is the 20th percentile in mass, and then the dashed curve is the 40th percentile in mass, and the open squares is the 80th percentile in mass. Okay, so color is Z-tube or X-tube, and the type of design is tells you what radius you're at. Okay, so if we're interested in globular cluster systems, we're pretty much just going to be interested in these two open squares curves. They don't change much with gas fraction since you're talking about way far out. Right. So the key thing that sticks out of this is that the major axis tube orbits in the outer regions are pretty much 100% streaming. Now, if I look at remerger remnants, that's spheroid-spheroid mergers of the remnants of these disk-disk mergers, this is what the data looks like. So you see this huge jump from total streaming with the major axis tube orbits to only 20% streaming or something in the remerger remnants. Now, why is that? That is a very simple explanation in the simulations. How do you get to be on a major axis tube orbit in these simulations? Well, the only way, you somehow got to have a lot of tangential velocity about the long axis, right? But if you remember that picture that I showed you at the beginning, the remnant is elongated along the direction of the approach of the two galaxies, so their orbital angular momentum is all perpendicular to that. You don't get any tangential velocity about the long axis from the initial orbital angular momentum. Furthermore, you don't get a lot of scattering into tangential orbits about the long axis because the violent relaxation is pretty much happening in the radial direction, connecting the centers of mass of the two galaxies. So basically, the only source of tangential velocity about the long axis in the initial conditions is the initial disk spins if they're inclined. And of course, the disks are, you know, they're cold disks to start out with, so they're going to be rotating in a well-defined sense about that axis, right? And that gives you pretty much 100% streaming motion. Now here, you know, the systems start out velocity dispersion dominated, not streaming dominated. They're not disks. So you get tangential velocity about the long axis just from the random motions of the stars, and it's not all streaming, right? And that picture is confirmed by this. If I do a coplanar merger of two disks, zero X-tube orbits. There's some phase space for them in the outer regions, which is what's shown by this line here, but that space is totally unoccupied. There are no long axis tube orbits in a coplanar merger. So that's consistent with the picture where long axis tube orbits come entirely from memory if the disk spins. Now, why is that relevant to globular cluster formation? Well, that way I can tell. You know, if I did Schwarzschild modeling or something in the outer regions, and I could extract some of the globular clusters that had large tangential velocities about the long axis, if they were all streaming, or they were totally absent, that would be telling me that these things probably formed in the disk, right? If, on the other hand, if they started out in a halo, they should look something like this. They shouldn't be all streaming in the same direction about the long axis of the potential. So I think that's an example of how, separating globular cluster systems by kinematics can tell us a lot about their formation. I think I'll stop there. That's too detailed. Just conclusions. So we can learn a lot about galaxy formation from globular cluster kinematics. Thinking of them as halo tracers, we can also learn about globular cluster formation from globular cluster kinematics. In particular, looking maybe at correlations between the mass function and the kinematics. And the last thing I'm going to say, just because this has come up a lot, just 30 seconds on this mass function stuff. So there's this sort of debate about whether you can possibly get, correct me, those who know more about this than me, if I'm stating it the wrong way. But I've taken from this workshop that, there's a big debate about whether you can possibly get mass functions that are universal in the sense that the turnover mass doesn't depend on radius within the galaxy and it doesn't vary from galaxy to galaxy. If galaxies were influenced by the tidal fields of their host galaxies, you would think you wouldn't get a universal mass function, right? And then also just the fact that, I guess, for the outer globular clusters, there just doesn't seem to be enough of a tidal field to strip off the lower end of the mass function. So we have these questions. Can you possibly sort of preserve the picture of tidal field-dependent evaporation and yet explain universal mass functions? So basically, there seem to be three different ways that people have come up with to solve this, to sort of get universal mass functions from tidal stripping. One is maybe the leading one right now, just that globular clusters evolve primarily through processes that don't depend on the external tidal field, right? Whether it's you want to say that two-body relaxation is primarily governed by the internal properties of the globular cluster, or like in the last talk, maybe the turnover is actually imprinted in their initial formation or something. That's obviously one possibility. The second possibility is that maybe these globular clusters formed in much denser satellite halos and were just kind of dumped into their present halos. So the tidal field that they've experienced over cosmological history is not the tidal field of the galaxy they're in now. It's the tidal field of some much denser subsystem that they formed in. The third possibility is that maybe it has to do with the orbits that the globular clusters are on, right? that maybe they're on highly radial orbits that take them right through the center of the galaxy. Maybe they're on tangential orbits today, but at some point in the history of time-varying potential, merger potential, or something like that, they flew through the center of the galaxy and got a tiny strike, something like that. So of these three possibilities, I guess this is the only one that I can really speak to with the work that I've described. Along those lines, I'm now, a few weeks ago, I guess, started this ongoing project with Enrico and Fred and other people. It's just sort of tracking the tidal histories of particles through the merger simulations instead of just looking at their paracenter in the static potential at the end of the merger. And following the histories of these particles, if you look at a given globular cluster, a particle representing the globular cluster in the simulation, what's the strongest tidal field that's ever experienced throughout the history of the merger? And I think that will definitely, that ought to be able to definitively eliminate this one if it doesn't work, right? And then we're just left with these two possibilities. So, sorry for taking so long. But.
Good.
Given that it's almost 5 o'clock.
It's not even 5 o'clock.
Finishing your questions.
Okay,
you're just
here for you.
What?
Which SCF code do you use?
Which one? Read it because I heard this master paper in 19.
You wrote it from scratch?
Yeah, I read it from scratch. No, but it's not self-consistent. It's just right now. I am working on a self-consistent code. I write from scratch a code that just calculates the SCF coefficients from a particle distribution. Right now, I'm actually doing a very interesting project that. Maybe I should talk about it another time. I know people need to leave. But the idea is testing this idea of scattering of box orbits and form the dominant Z2 population in these galaxies by writing a code that updates the SCF coefficients, but much less frequently than it is needed for the individual time steps of the particles. So it's like a completely individually timed step of the code.
Yeah,
you use a Wheeler-Stahr integrator to integrate the trajectories of the particles, and you slowly, adiabatically add some kind of perturbation to the potential, and then just compute the SCF coefficients every 100 times.
Right, that was written 10 years ago. You can grab it up the web right now.
Oh, really? Okay. And that gets up in the last time. I bet it was written in C.
Good.
It was written in Fortran.
No, we're getting into a tough discussion.
Sverre has gone already, so we are
happy. But you're still being recorded.
Even if it's written.